Pat Metheny has a new recording out. It's called Road to the Sun. This is a jazz guitarist and composer who's been around for more than four decades. He's earned some 20 Grammy Awards in 10 different categories. And during the pandemic, he says he's pretty happy just hanging out and making music 10 to 12 hours a day. He says as a musician, that's what he does. He spends a lot of time just figuring out why the B flat wants to go to the A. You're going to be finding out a lot more about Pat Metheny and how he was inspired to write some classical pieces. And by classical pieces, we mean music that he's actually written down. It's not just improvised. He wrote one work for a guitar quartet, in fact, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, and the other for solo guitarist Jason Vio. You're going to hear about it now on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.
Thanks for inviting me, you guys.
Thank you for making time.
Well, like a lot of people, I have extra time on my hands these days, so.
One of the things that was on my mind when I started to look at your bio and I saw how many concerts you do every year, I thought, wow, that must be a real culture shock to go from, 240 concerts a year to probably almost none, or maybe some streamed concerts. What have you been doing during the pandemic?
Well, you know, the 240 concert a year figure has stuck around way past the point that I've actually done 240 concerts in one year. I mean, there was a 10-year period in there where that was true, but, you know, I still do a lot, relatively speaking, but it's more like 120, 140 a year. It's not like 240 like it used to be. Nevertheless, this is absolutely the most amount of time I've had off since junior high school, probably. And it's been interesting. The main headline for me would be, just, you know, everybody's healthy, my kids, my wife, and my immediate family, you know, and unfortunately in the community at large that I kind of hang in, I mean, we've lost some key players in this period that, you know, that's the part of it, you know, that's the worst. And then the second worst part of it is not just the lack of performing, but the impact that it's had on what is a pretty fragile community anyway, not just the players, but the, you know, the people around, you know, the people who work in venues, the people who are working crews and promoters and, you know, performing arts center operators. I mean, just, it, you know, the amount of kind of lost opportunities to do our thing is just kind of multiplied by all of those individual people. And, you know, for me personally, I am maybe a little bit better suited than, say, some of the younger guys in the community because, you know, I've been around a while and I've, you know, I grew up with a father who was constantly on me to make sure to save for a rainy day and all that stuff. So I've been able to weather this and the kids have been able to eat and everything. But we're kind of nearing the point now where it's starting to get more and more critical. I hope everybody's taking their vaccine and doing the thing so we can get back to this, you know, and it's not like it's over either. I mean, I think I start to see people acting like, oh, okay, now we're going to be able to plan for this or that. And it's like, no, I don't see that. I mean, maybe the States, it's a little bit better now after being really terrible for a long time, but internationally, man, Europe is still like really a mess. And, you know, most of my stuff is international stuff more than the States. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's definitely been challenging, no question.
You mentioned that you're in kind of a remote area. Where are you now?
I'm in upstate New York, kind of in the deep Catskill Forest Reserve. You know, mostly, you know, I'm in the city, but, once the kids' schools got remote, you know, last spring, we, we've been up here for most of it.
Are your kids school age then, like high school, junior high?
Yeah. Well, one, I mean, they range from 11 up to 21. So two are college kids and our 11-year-old is in sixth grade.
I've talked to a lot of musicians like you who are appreciating that extra family time, if you will. How's that going for you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, it's, you know, it's been fantastic in that respect that, you know, both boys, you know, came home from college, too, because there was no point in them being where they were. So, yeah, we've all been together in this, you know, place and we're fine and everything's cool. You know, that's all, it's all good in that respect. You know, the challenges of having a sixth grader at home with like, okay, let's add another 8 hours a day on the iPad is like, you know, the worst possible thing. I mean, she's the one that I feel worst about, but, you know, hopefully maybe by the fall, it's all going to be possible for, you know, once all the teachers are vaccinated and everything, it seems like should be able to resume. That's what we're hoping for.
And do you have other musicians in this pod of yours?
No. You know, we've really kind of kept to ourselves as directed by the CDC. I mean, you know, we've really kept a very close pod thing going of just us. You know, to talk about musical things, I mean, like most musicians, it's no problem for me to stay in a room by myself 10 or 12 hours a day, because that's sort of what you got to do at some point along the way. And, you know, I'm really fine with that, you know, practicing, working on music. I mean, honestly, if there's anything that's coming from this, from my standpoint, it's something I've known and has been emerging for a while, but yeah, I mean, I love going out and playing for people and, you know, I love being part of the community of musicians, but mostly what I love is music. And I'm very happy to just stay in a room by myself and study, work on music. You know, to me, the payoff has always been not the stuff around the music, but music, being a musician. And, you know, I'm a good example of somebody that, you know, I mean, whatever the so-called progressive education model is, which I've learned about through the kids of, you know, that you learn through the things that you love as opposed to, you know, a rigorous sort of curriculum that's established by the, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, I stopped taking books home in sixth grade because I was practicing 10 or 12 hours a day, like I just described. And everything I've ever learned about science, math, history, you know, everything else I learned through music. And music is very unusual in the sense that it contains all of that, in addition to an infinity of other things that are kind of indescribable and have indescribable benefits. So, you know, for me, yeah, it's fun to go out and play, but I'm really quite happy to just sort of, you know, figure out why that B flat wants to go to the A and, you know, like, what does that mean? So, you know, it's like that for me.
It's interesting, though, and maybe this has changed, but when I was reading about your background, you know, you grew up in Kansas City and you kind of learned on the job, if you will. And at that point, anyway, you hadn't had any formal guitar lessons. Has that changed in your world throughout the years?
Well, you're right. I learned how to play from playing with really great musicians. And I was incredibly lucky to be, you know, kind of around the Kansas City area during a period where there happened to be a lot of great players and just a handful of guitar players. So I got a lot of gigs when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. Not because I was really all that great, but I just kind of lucked into an era where there were opportunities that were there and older musicians who, you know, gave me a chance to hang. It was quite different than the sort of jazz education model that now exists, you know, where people can get through 4 years of college without playing a gig. I mean, you know, I was working four or five nights a week starting from, you know, when I was 15. You know, regarding the formal training aspect of it, I mean, I would say that in the general community of musicians that I have been lucky to hang in all these years, the formality of it is completely decided after somebody goes 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, and how you can hang. And the way that you get to the point of being able to hang or not hang has as many individual paths as there are individual musicians. So in my case, given those opportunities where I was around people who would say, do you know blah, 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 such and such standard tune, and I either did or didn't. If I didn't, my training was to go home that night and not only learn it, but be able to play it in, if not all 12 keys, at least, you know, 4 or 5 different keys, because the organ player that I was playing with, once he understood that I could play it in one key, would play it in another key the next night, you know. You know, I was very lucky in that respect, but the issue of formality, and I would say actually with all kinds of music, is it's something that exists on paper, but, you know, in reality, we're musicians, and our currency is the sound that we make or the notes that we leave on a page for other musicians to play. How you evolve to be able to do that, I think is... I mean, I can cite every possible example of the way people get there.
Improvisation is key to your style, and you have been part of research relating to how the brain works when we improvise. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I've had some really interesting opportunities to present whatever my thing is in front of a whole bunch of people over the years. But I think probably the most unusual of those was that I had to give the keynote speech for 5,000 neuroscientists at the International Convention of Neuroscientists a couple years ago, which was very interesting. And yeah, the theme, the topic of discussion was improvising, which is in fact an area of particular interest to several aspects of what they study and how the brain works. And, you know, it was an incredibly enriching experience for me, not only to have to prepare a talk like that, but then the few days afterwards of hanging out and really getting to discuss some of the things that I brought up in the talk with some people who are incredibly brilliant people.
Was there any interesting discovery that has really stuck with you so far?
Well, you know, one thing that, especially as musicians and improvising musicians, we enjoy a kind of exalted status. You know, it's like, you know, like I always think about in like Round Midnight, that movie, like where there's the French jazz fan who goes up to Dexter Gordon and says, you were like gods tonight. You know, the truth is, it's like, you know, Dexter Gordon played 6 sets a night, 6 nights a week all over the world for 60 years. So it was, you know, set number 3 for him. And yes, part of the job description is that we have to be able to make up some new stuff each time we play and make it real. But I think that that does tend to get... This is the exalted part. People think, oh, you're going to make up a completely new language every time you play. No. And I would say that, like, what we're doing right now is improvising, too. Like, you knew you were going to do this interview. I knew I was going to be on the receiving part of asking questions. But, you know, I didn't know exactly what you were going to ask, and you didn't know exactly how I was going to respond. But, you know, we both kind of had a sense of the form that was going to happen. And whether it's the guy that's coming to diagnose your refrigerator that needs to get fixed, I mean, he's improvising too. We're all improvising all the time, and we all have different structures and forms that we're familiar with. And this aspect of things and how it relates to language for neuroscientists, music is an interesting thing because it does have a language component. I mean, it registers in some similar ways to language, but it also has this other thing that I think that's where it gets interesting for them. And, you know, from the standpoint of consciousness, because that's a very important part of their studies and still remains a little bit elusive in terms of something they can really define. In music, we have a very similar elusive, undefinable component, which is soul. And without that, it's not even music. So, you know, as much as we can talk about a lot of the things that surround improvising or music or consciousness or speech or language, there are these doors that do remain closed where the real thing lives. And, you know, that's where my, like, the gratitude that I have of being able to live a life as a musician, where I've been able to kind of really trade in whatever that currency is, which is something mysterious, but also very true. It's like really valuable. Like, you wake up every morning and B flat is still B flat, you know? There's no culture, there's no politics around that. It is. And, you know, that part of it all for me is something that I really cherish. And I think to the degree that it can be studied on an MRI or something like that, which is kind of what those guys are doing, it's fascinating, no question.
It's International Guitar Month. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not know that.
It's also International Jazz Month, and you just seem to fall right in the middle of both of those. However, on your new recording, you're crossing into the classical genre a little bit. Is this the first time you've done that?
You know, honestly, when people start talking about genres of music, my eyes kind of glaze over because I really don't know exactly what people mean. Sometimes, very often, you know, to me, when genres are brought in, it's almost always, to me, a political discussion. It's about the clothes the person is wearing or the way this group of people relates to that group of people or whatever. You know, to me, there is this issue of music that's improvised versus music that's written that is a real thing. And that's where I would place any discussion about the current project in a context, which is, yes, it is the first release that I've put out after all these many releases where every note is on a page. I wrote everything for these musicians whose specialty is interpreting notes on a page. And, you know, my main job really over all these years has been not really guitar player, although I do play guitar. You know, it's more been like band leader slash conceptualist or something like that. And the guitar is a really useful translation device for me. It's been great to be able to have a relationship with an instrument where I can use it to get ideas out. But I kind of started composing music because I was unable to get to some areas that I really wanted to get to as an improviser. And I found if I wrote a bunch of stuff on a page, people would actually play it. And that was kind of a light bulb moment for me where, like, you know, I wasn't asking somebody a favor, like, would you mind playing, you know, boom, 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 as opposed to, you know, whatever else. If it's on the page, people go, oh, they take it a little more seriously. And that was sort of the opening of the gauntlet for me, you know, where early things were just 16 bars on a page, and now it's like 300 pages of written material. I've written a lot of notes over the years for a lot of great musicians, but this is the first time where it's not leading to improvising. It's a standalone, you know, thing that what I left on the page, people will be able to play it 100 years from now with no improvisational requirements, skills needed. And, you know, it's funny that it took me this long to get to that, because usually that's where people start and then they go to improvising afterwards, but it was kind of backwards for me.
You composed two pieces for Road to the Sun, which are new compositions for specific performers. And the first is for a soloist, the other for a guitar quartet. I want to start by talking about the piece that you wrote for Jason Veo. He put out a recording in 2005 called Images of Matheny. And then you reached out to him and mentioned, you know, at some point, I might just write a piece for you. What was Jason's reaction when you told him that?
Well, I had been a fan of Jason from the time he came on the scene, just for his unbelievable ability as a, you know, interpreter. Particularly his Bach playing to me is like the, he's almost set a new standard for that. And you know, when he did the his arrangements and versions of my tunes, it was just incredibly flattering that a musician at that level would even, you know, address it. He's a very interesting guy in the sense that he can also talk about Metallica for 4 hours, you know? I mean, he's like, you know, he has the kind of broad sense that I was describing before, kind of from a slightly different angle of just kind of embracing music in this big way. And there are things that I saw him and heard him do as a performer playing written music that really inspired me to think, well, you know, I should think about what it would be like to notate a lot of the things that I do and that I hear. And also things that I know that Jason can do. I mean, one of my things about being a band leader over all these years is that basically my life has been finding really great musicians who have particular talents. And then because I'm the guy that writes 90% of the notes that we play, writing music for them that challenges them, hopefully, but also sort of, in my opinion, as the sort of, you know, curator of their talent for a minute, you know, this is what I love about what this person can do. And that's the way that I approached writing for Jason, is that I wanted to not only take advantage of those things that I know he's great at, but I also wanted to not be giving him a piece that he'd be able to sight read. I feel like you, when you hire somebody to be in your band, you have an obligation to their talent, to, you know, the analogy I always make. It's like if you're hiring Albert Einstein to be in your math department, you don't want him to teach eighth grade algebra. You want to say, hey, Albert, man, you know, we want you to, you know, also do some research here. You know, it's like, so getting somebody like Jason on, you know, on board, and, you know, it's like, I want to make sure that it's something that is taking advantage of what he does, but also pushing it a little bit.
The piece that you wrote for Jason Veo, Four Paths of Light, why is it called that?
Well, at this point, I'm about 500 titles in. Titles are my absolute nemesis. It takes way longer to come up with a title for something than it ever takes me to write or finish anything. Any ideas that I had about words or language, you know, ran out at about title number 34. So it's really difficult for me to get, you know, something that hopefully doesn't get in the way. You know, to me, you want a title to almost disappear somehow. And at the same time, it has to fit. It has to rhyme with the piece some way or another. And I have to say, both of those pieces really were problems for me to come up with titles that did the thing. Somehow, you know, after hundreds of tries of long lists of potential titles, it gets to the point eventually where the record company is like, if we don't have the credits by tomorrow, the release is going to be delayed. So you, at that point, you just go, okay, well, I guess this one's okay. And in this case, you know, I thought both titles were actually pretty good. So they fit somehow. I don't even know why.
Well, they're great titles, but now I understand why the movements are just called Part 1, Part 2, Part 3.
Oh, yeah, the thought of coming up with another 10 titles, subtitles, forget
That's
it.
That's hilarious. Well, let me talk about, I want to ask you a little bit about the movements within Four Paths of Light. And you might have already answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The first movement was inspired by your love of the heavy metal band Pantera. They were known for creating the power groove in the 90s. And now you tell me Jason Veo also kind of was a heavy metal fan as well. Is that how you connected those ideas for the first movement?
You know, I never really thought of that, but probably subconsciously my knowledge of his knowledge of that general area. Yeah, maybe that was a component. He did say that he had never been asked to play that violently. What I was looking for more was the kind of dynamics that are expressed in that, where, you know, certain lines start very soft and then get loud quickly. And that's really hard to do. He has the kind of technique and the kind of touch, and also a particular instrument that's very good at that. And it's an intense look at what that can be. And, you know, the relationship to Pantera in particular is, yeah, they really were ridiculously precise with the way they played eighth notes and 16th notes. And that piece is asking for that, for sure.
That reminds me that dynamics are really, really important to you, as well as the rhythm, and we hear that throughout both of these pieces. The Brazilian choro rhythm takes center stage in the second movement. Why did you choose to use that style for that movement?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I would call it that. There's a real overlap between, you know, okay, we could call it bossa nova, but also like 60s pop music, you know, which is kind of connected to sort of American folk music in the sense that it's kind of like duple rhythm, like da 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 da, as opposed to da 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 da, which so much pop music prior to the rock and roll era sort of had triplets underneath it. And, you know, for me, the switch to duple meter kind of happened simultaneously around the world somehow. You know, in the early 60s, mid 60s somehow, bossa nova was certainly an incredible manifestation of that. But to, you know, the exact choro thing, no, that's not what that is. A choro is a little bit, the thing is, things that have a clave, that have a specific beat, that is something I actually avoid like the plague, because my reference always is Tony Williams, the Miles Quintet, where there was no pure clave, it was just swinging. And so for me, what I was interested in was having this even eighth note flow, you know, that was coming mostly from the ride cymbal, actually. It wasn't coming from the bass drum. It wasn't coming from a particular conga pattern. It was this even eighth note flow that was swinging, but it wasn't triplets. And to me, like 90% of everything I've ever done is roughly even eighth note. So you know, to do a real choro, you really have to kind of stick to some kind of specific stuff. And, you know, I resist that, honestly. You know, I'm more about the sort of freedom of the drummer. And I like to, you know, the drums are everything for me, even if there's no drummer there.
The fourth movement in this solo work revisits the melody from the second movement in a new light. And here, you make use of an hypnotic tremolo, but it's not a Spanish style. Can you talk about how you approach that?
Well, you know, that particular technique was something that was always mysterious to me, even though I am a guitar player. I never really quite knew what was going on when I would hear people do that. And actually, one of the things that's been really fun for me, because I never really hung out with, you know, written music guitar players that much. So being around these five guys, who all of whom are amongst the greatest on the planet, I was kind of able to, like, how do you guys do that? How do you do that thing that you guys, I hear you guys do? And Jason was particularly great because he actually gave me a really cool guitar lesson early on when we first met, kind of explaining sort of what that is and how you do that. And so I knew that I wanted to get to something like that in the piece for Jason.
Is this a piece of music that you yourself will perform or are performing?
You know, I've always got way more stuff than I can perform. I mean, already the concerts are 3 hours long. I wish they could be like 14 or 15 hours long so that I could play everything.
Well, that would be a Wagner opera then, you see.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I can dig it. That's, you know, that seems about right to me, you know. But probably not, because I'll be on to whatever the next thing is, you know.
I was just thinking, because it was something written down and improvisation is so key to what you do, I was just curious if that would be a different challenge for you as a performer.
Well, I would say that there are components of what this is, you know, that are, I mean, you know, I often talk about, because people, you know, because I mostly am an improvising musician, and now here's, you know, several hundred pages of written material, like, how do those things connect? You know, what I usually say to explain that is, you know, they're related activities that happen at completely different temperatures. You know, it's like when you write a piece of music, you know, you can sit around for 6 weeks deciding whether, you know, it should be an A or a B flat. You know, if you're on a bandstand and you're playing with a great drummer and there's 4,000 people there, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, you need to decide right now, is that an A or a B flat? But the musician that you are, the personality that you have, the taste that you have, all of the things that make you the musician that you are the same. So even though this is written, the impulses are very similar. It's just that I can really think about it a lot more. I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, it's written, but the musicianship or the, you know, the things that make whatever my thing be what it is are all in place, whether they're improvised or not.
The members of the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, Bill Kannengeiser in particular, was really surprised at how involved you got in composing that Road to the Sun, literally to the point where you had pictures of each of them up as you were writing parts for them specifically. It wasn't just four guitar parts. You wrote specific pieces for them. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, this goes a little bit back to the band leader thing for me. That's what I always do, you know? I always write for the people that I've got in my band. And I mean, I got really good over the years at sort of coming up with all of these different ways, like this is the group and this is the trio and now there's this. They're all the Pat Metheny group, you know? Even if I'm not playing, it's that, you know? My main gig is sort of the conceptual foundation that I want to build to offer great musicians the chance to do what, in my opinion, they're really good at. And in this case, each one of those guys has a very particular sound, you know, and a very particular way of playing and a very particular personality. And I had written this 30-minute thing as an idea, a musical idea. Okay, now is the part where I have to be the band leader. And in this case, instead of having a rehearsal and saying, okay, can you do this? Can you do that? You know, I'm going to write on the page, Bill, can you do this? Because that's the world that these guys live in. That's their language, is to take written notes and then do their thing with it. So for me, it's just kind of another way of being a band leader. You know, also to take advantage of, you know, different combinations of those guys, just like I would with my band. It's like, you know, sometimes I stop and it's just the bass and the drums playing, or it's just the bass and the piano player playing. You know, it's like you want to explore all those combinations. So by having their pictures there and a score, you know, like where the pictures are across the spectrum as they sit on stage, so that I can imagine that, okay, sometimes I'm going to let the two guys in the middle rest and the two guys on either end are going to play a duet, and then now it's going to be the two guys in the middle. You know, stuff like that. That's just kind of kind of the basic stuff, you know. And yet, you know, it is written just like the one for Jason was written for Jason. This was written for those guys. And they're really different kinds of players. So I wanted to honor that.
I know there was a section you were writing where you wanted to be able to use the left thumb or something. And because classical guitarists don't do that, you had to ask them, is this okay? And you got a flat no. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a no five ways across. Jason, too. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing, to tell you the truth, on the guitar. I mean, when I see a video of myself playing, it's like, oh, my God, you know, it's just, it couldn't be more of a mess. Because I didn't really think about it. I just think about what's the idea, what's the sound. And, you know, and so, yeah, I use my thumb constantly, you know, wrapped around the guitar, like all the way to the fourth string, to get certain voicings that actually you can't get any other way. And yeah, those guys won't do that. And I mean, they would claim that you can't do that on their kind of guitars because the neck is too wide. But I picked up their guitars and I was like, yeah, you can do this. But there's kind of a thing in their world of, like, you keep your thumb on the back of the neck at all times. And so, cool. I respect that. It's a cultural issue.
There are six parts in this suite, Road to the Sun, and you joined the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet on parts 2 and 5. Why?
One of the things guitar is really good at is probably the most, you know, commonplace use for the instrument, which is as this sort of portable percussive harmonic device that you can, you know, stick on the back of your horse and, you know, and explore the entire North American continent, and at night around the campfire have this incredible accompaniment device. You know, you get the chords and you get the rhythm. And of course, you know, we all kind of learn the first, you know, four chords that you can play Michael Row the Boat Ashore, you know, sitting around the campfire. You get four or five guys doing that, it sounds amazing. I mean, it's just a great sound. The guitars are usually a little out of tune with each other, and you know, maybe people's timing is a little off or whatever, but it's this sound unlike anything else. Or the Rolling Stones. I mean, you know, whatever that is with those two guys, like, kind of just bashing away playing chords, you know, it's like multiple guitars is really a cool sound. And it's also one of the most dangerous environments because it can be just a complete mess. It almost always is, actually. And that's where Western notation is fantastic for that. And the LA Guitar Quartet is great at that. But I've, you know, my thing in a lot of departments is I don't see why things that are considered mutually exclusive are mutually exclusive. So, you know, I wanted to get those guys to get back to their Michael Row the Boat Ashore roots that must be there somewhere and do a kind of strumming that is what that is. And I think for people in their general zone, the first reference that they have to that kind of technique is flamenco music, where there is it's even got a name, which I can't remember, it starts with an R, I think, of a certain kind of what I would call strumming that you do with all of your fingers, as opposed to with a pick, which is what I do. And I really wanted to communicate to them, and in fact, it's even a note on the score. It says, not flamenco. It was like, what it isn't. And it kind of kept veering towards that. And, you know, I would say, you know, the really tricky, hard stuff, of which there's plenty in Road to the Sun, that was really manageable for them. Getting the strumming thing to do what I hoped it could do, they, I think, admittedly were challenged by that. So, you know, I would sit around in rehearsals and I would say, it's like this, and I would do it. And as long as I was doing it with them, they could get to that thing. And when I would stop, they would still be able to do it, but it wasn't quite as folky sounding. So for the record, I thought, you know, because I had a reference track of me doing it. And when I was mixing it, I turned up the reference track and I was like, you know, maybe I'll just leave a little bit of that in. You don't exactly hear it. It's just kind of in there under everything. And it seemed to glue it all together. I liked it, so I left it on there.
In one interview, I read that you're attracted to expansive works as a way to reject the scaling back in our culture. Too much is reduced to sound bites, and nuance goes out the window, you said. Can you talk about that and how it might relate to Road to the Sun?
Well, I would say that probably relates to everything in my life as a musician, in the sense that, right from the beginning, probably the average track length for me is, you know, 12 minutes or so. So growing up where I did, where I was hearing a lot of pop music that was 3 minutes long, now being around three kids who listen to mostly tunes that are 3 minutes long, actually now it's more like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. You know, I understand the virtue of that. And, you know, I don't think of anything as being mutually exclusive to anything else. My default is to go ahead and let things sort of sprawl. I like that. I mean, you mentioned Wagner before. I went to see Tristan three times this past season, you know, gladly. And, you know, so for me, yeah, like 4 hours, yeah, that's great. But also it's a matter of skill in a way too. It's like, you know, I always like that quote, and my answers fit into this too today. Sorry, this is such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one. And sorry, my answers are so long.
I have to say that tracks 8 and 9, which I think are part 4 and 5, are the two sections that I just keep hitting repeat on. And I think that that might be because that is where I am hearing the vintage Matheny, especially in part 5.
Well, part 5, I had a fork in the road moment there, which is the one thing I had not done up to that point was feature each guy individually. And, you know, I sort of had set up the material that led up to the moment I'm about to describe, where each guy is featured, where I could have just wrapped it up there. And, you know, what it was sort of asking for was something that would have been not unlike what an improvised solo would do. And at the same time, those guys would be the first to tell you, except for Matt, who is a good improviser. But the other three guys, they do not consider themselves professional improvisers. You know, they're classical guys that play notes on a page. And at the same time, they each have amazing skills. And so I kind of was like, okay, let me not think of this as improvised, but sort of fulfilling that function. And I'm going to write a little feature section for each guy, but I'm going to go ahead and draw from the improviser's mentality that I carry with me anyway, but I'm going to bring it to the forward part a little bit more. And I literally just kind of played in my mind sort of a quote-unquote solo. And as I played it, I just wrote it out with a pencil on a page. And I thought, okay, Matt. And then, you know, then I kind of thought, Scott. And, you know, kind of played a solo in my mind thinking of Scott and wrote that out in pencil. And Bill and John.
as a musical pioneer on many fronts, and you've also invented a few of your own instruments, and one of those instruments appears on the Arvo Pärt piece, which wraps up this recording. Tell me a little bit about this 42-string Picasso guitar.
Well, I've been really lucky to have a great association with a guitar maker in Canada whose name is Linda Manzer, and she's made a whole bunch of instruments for me over the years. And it is game for stuff. You know, it's like, you know, the people around me, musicians, crew people, and Linda especially, the dreaded phrase that they hate to hear from me is something that starts with, how hard would it be? And fill in the blank. And in this case, it was followed by to take a 6-string guitar and have as many other strings as you could possibly fit on there across the body, the goal being so that I could have, first of all, some resonant overtone opportunities, but also the envy of guitar players to piano players is the sustain pedal. Because on a piano, you can hold down the sustain pedal, play some notes, and then play some other notes on top of that, and people think you're a genius, you know. It's like on guitar, you got to hold everything down, and once you take your finger off, it stops. So it was sort of like, how could I get to that kind of an effect, you know, and have things ringing on top of each other? And Linda thought about it for, I think it was a number of years. I actually did a little sketch on a napkin or something, which made her, you know, go to her real drawing board. And she figured out how to make an instrument that had 42 strings on it, doing exactly what I just described. And that's been close to 40 years ago now. It's a long time ago. And I've used it in many different ways over the years. I've tuned it lots of different ways. There's a chromatic approach to it. There's a way that you can do it where you have several harmonic zones. But in this case, I had been fascinated by that piece. Of course, it's a well-known piano piece. And right away, I was like, you know, I could probably get to that on the 42-string guitar if I tuned the whole thing to this general diatonic area, because it's a piece that remains kind of in one diatonic key. And I did it as an experiment one night. And then once everything else was done, you know, I gave it a try for real. And it fit somehow with this, not only for its being a written piece, but also my pieces modulate to different keys about every 10 seconds. I mean, I'm like all over the place. And this really hangs in this one key, which seemed like a kind of a relief almost at the end of everything to have that piece.
Pat Metheny talking about his latest venture, Road to the Sun.